Okay, so today we're going to continue talking about buffer overflows. First, on the homework on buffer overflows. So it's due a week from Friday, so you have 2 weeks to do it because I think it's harder. And there's a big hint in the assignment, so I gave a kind of fumbled and I might have scared people off GDB demo to show that you don't need the sort of information we give you in the assignment to actually figure out these buffer overflows. Like, for the assignment, we tell you it's in GetS, and that's a big hint, and you can follow the sort of reverse engineer the assembly technique, and that will work pretty well. But and you use the debugger just to find little things like, where's the stack pointer? But the debugger is more powerful than that. It's more helpful if you didn't have that sort of hint, which might not always happen. So any questions on the assignment? That would be for people who've actually looked at it, which I hope is, you know, some set of the people who bothered to come to class. Okay, so last time when we finished off, we were talking about sort of things that exploit buffer overflows and other types of memory errors. This general category beyond stack smashing. So stack smashing was really nice. It was this very generic technique. The only condition we needed basically was that the thing that was being overflowed was on the stack. But we have some other choices which are more flexible and will let us have exploits in more circumstances. They don't work all the time like stack smashing, but they'll deal with things people have tried to do to make sure stack smashing doesn't work, or situations where people thought, well, woo, that buffer is on the heap, I'm safe, because I can't use stack smashing. You know, there's other techniques you can use, hackers can use. And we sort of had our basic thing was that, you know, the obvious thing is you could get really lucky. Like, you could have the thing you want to attack right next to the buffer, like the score next to the quiz answer. That's not something you really want to count on. And we had a different technique, which was where, you know, you might not do this normal stack smashing thing and take advantage of other things that happen to be next to your buffer. Or do things other than return to code that you supply. And the first thing we mentioned, which we'll go in more detail later, is that, well, there's things besides the return address in many programs, besides the buffer to return to in many programs. Like, there's a function that does what you want. For example, if the code is like, if you are an authorized user, then do this, you might jump to the do this, would be a good address to put there. And as we'll talk in several lectures, that this technique is way more flexible than it seems. It turns out that we can do this sort of thing on programs which it would seem like they shouldn't have the stuff we want to do already in them, but it turns out that pretty much any program will. And the other thing we got to was overwriting data pointers. And this is where we're lucky in the sense that we have some pointer on the stack and some value that's going to be written to that pointer on the stack. So this is what we call an arbitrary memory write. So by overflowing the stack pointer, the buffer, we can set these two values to whatever we want and write memory wherever we want. And the simplest thing to do is that we can use this to do stack smashing. We can overwrite the return address in spite of something like a stack canary, that technique which was supposed to keep us from doing stack smashing. So now we're not quite doing stack smashing anymore. Done better. But the return address isn't the only thing that we might be able to overwrite. So there's other types of things in memory that are really useful to overwrite. So for example, if we had other pointers to code and functions, if we could somehow overwrite machine code, that would be good. If we could overwrite other data pointers, we might be able to use that to have something that happens to be next to the thing we care about, or make something point to the thing we care about even if it's not next to our buffer. So there's other ways we can take advantage of this. And in particular, as a technique, that replaces stack smashing, this is very unattractive. We talked about how the starting address of the stack varied a lot, and it varied a lot because we put things on there that were like the arguments to our program. And we could probably figure out exactly what it is. It's not impossible. There's not information that we would usually think the attacker will never have. But that's not something we want to assume that the attacker can accurately predict where to make this pointer go to make this work. So is there an easier target? So can you think of some other thing other than the return address that we've maybe talked about or seen in this class that we might want to overwrite? And as a hint, you can think about ways that viruses got themselves executed. So those were places where, yeah. Yeah, so if we looked at how Vienna worked, you might think that we can just edit some machine code. We can just do a write where the value we're writing is a call instruction and the pointer is some code that's somewhere in the middle of the program. And that code in the middle of the program is probably easier to guess the location of than the stack pointer. And this seems like a perfectly logical strategy, and it won't work. And the reason why it won't work is that we've advanced since the days of DOS. So on a DOS system, it would work. But on a modern system, there is some form of memory protection. So you can't write all memory. In particular, usually addresses where you load code from executables and libraries, that code that's loaded from executables and libraries are read-only. So you can't do this. But if you can find code which isn't read-only for some reason, then you could do it. And there are programs which have code which isn't read-only deliberately. For example, programs which compile code on the fly might do this, but it's not common. So is there another candidate, some other thing we've talked about, which should be writable? Yeah. So I guess we didn't think of it quite in this context. So it turns out that in real programs, there's lots of function pointers, especially in big programs. There's tons and tons of pointers to functions, so which are just addresses of code to run, which are used by the program. And these are the sorts of targets for overwriting. And these occur sort of both explicitly written by a programmer and used to implement sort of standard features of libraries you use and programming languages you use all the time. So who here has ever used a function pointer in C or C++? Like, four people, okay. So C function pointers have the most ridiculous syntax ever. This is how you declare a function pointer, which is compare is a pointer to a function which takes two char stars and returns an int. Yes, that's the real syntax. Yes, it doesn't make much sense. So this declares a variable for that. And we could use this, for example, if we're sorting. We can set compare to be whatever comparison function we want to use based on the type of things we're sorting and what our sorting policy is. That's a common real use of function pointers in C code. That, you know, sometimes you want to do a case-insensitive sort, sometimes you want to do a case-sensitive one. And rather than having your compare function have an if statement, you'll just change out which function you use. And if you can find where this function pointer is stored, that's sure a great thing to overwrite with a pointer to your code as an attacker. So once they compare things once, you just get control and you get to do whatever you want. You don't need to return. You're done. So explicit use like this work, but that's not like something you can rely on finding in every application. This is not something people do all the time. So I'm going to talk more about patterns where function pointers are used, including implicitly. And there's one form we've seen, but we haven't really talked about it as sort of function pointers, which is in dynamic linking. So if you remember when we talked about dynamic linking, we were doing all these tricks to avoid having to change code we were loading. And we had this indirection where we had a table lookup to find dynamically linked functions. And what that table lookup does, this jump to an address from a table, this address in particular, that's a function pointer. And in fact, as you can tell from this object dump output, it is at a fixed address that I can find out by just object dumping my target executable. And that's a great thing to override. So if I do my attack and change what's at this address, and the program tries to call printf, it's going to jump to the address that I, whatever address I put here, in this entry, this part of the global offset table, which is at a fixed address. Don't have to guess where the stack was. It's just there because the executable says that's where it is. And we know from lazy binding thing that exists that sometimes the linker doesn't actually fill in this table immediately. It fills it in as you call functions, that it's probably even writable. There's like a reason for it to be writable because of that. So it's likely writable and a great target for attackers because it's easy to find this address. You know, functions like printf are called all over the place. So like you probably don't even need to look. You just overwrite it and probably it will work. And there's targets besides printf like free or malloc or open. Lots of good candidates which will be in this sort of table, yes. So if we want to attack the global offset table, instead of having, when we overflow this buffer and change val and pointer by going beyond the end of the buffer, we just change pointer to point to a particular global offset table entry to be set to that address. And when the code in the original program uses the pointer to write value to it, it's going to change that for us. And if we set value correctly, we'll point to our malicious machine code. Yeah?
Would we still need to, would an attacker still need to do the actual function that, like, so if printf was then that was addressing overwritten, would the malicious code have to implement printf also?
So the question is, does the malicious code need to implement printf for this technique to work? Do we need to do this transparently? And the answer, unlike in a virus, where in a virus we typically want to be subtle. We want to just run the normal application. When we're talking about exploiting something, typically the way our exploit machine code, the malicious code we run, ends is by exiting. And if we're doing that, we don't need to implement printf. We're gonna mess things up anyways. By killing the application, we don't need to restore anything. And that's typically the way these things work, is that they'll just crash the program and hope that people won't notice too much. If they really wanted, they could try to not. But they usually don't care. There's usually not incentive for the attacker to do that. Yeah.
So are we getting the address for the global offset table just by guessing?
We're getting the address because it's fixed in the executable. This is my object dump output, and that's the address we're using. So it's part of the executable. It doesn't change. And we just get it by knowing what the target executable is. So presumably it's like commercial software or publicly distributed binaries, and we have a copy, and we can just look, or we can otherwise, guess, compile it ourselves, see where compilers typically put that, hope we get lucky, something like that. Other questions? Yeah.
Is there a problem that you're jumping to and then trying to execute code that's currently allocated as an array?
So the question is, when we're doing this, we're going to execute code that's part of an array. There's no type information in memory. Memory is just bytes. So the processor is not going to know better, as far as we know so far. So it would be nice if somehow we had some way of saying, this is supposed to be data. You shouldn't be running it as code and not run it as code. And in fact, we'll talk about some mitigations which basically do that, which say we're not going to let this run as code. They aren't going to actually solve this problem because here I'm having val be a pointer to the buffer. There's other things. If there's a useful function in the application, I could point there. So that do useful function case where like we have code which is like, if you're an authorized user, do this, we could point to do this. So this is still useful in the case where we can't, even if this buffer isn't something we could execute. We can use the same technique of overriding this nice, easy to find fixed address. Other questions? Okay, so this is one case, and this is probably the most commonly used target for a long time, as long as this is viable, because you know, if you don't know where the stack is, this is actually easier to find out. You need to look at a particular application. It's not quite as generic, because you need to like know a few more details about how it's compiled than you might need to know for stack smashing, where you just need to know how much is allocated on the stack, which is basically the same depending on how many local variables there are. But it's commonly used, it's pretty easy, it's reliable. There's other uses of function pointers in real code, which are more application specific, but they're surprisingly common. So most of you have never had a reason to write code with function pointers, but you've also probably not worked on, you know, 10,000 plus line C projects. And in large C projects, there are often lots and lots of function pointers around because they need modularity. And if you want modularity, being able to choose which version of a function you use is very helpful. So for example, this is an excerpt from the Linux kernel source code. This is something called struct file, which as you might guess, represents a file. This is the in-memory, in the Linux kernel representation of a file. And within this struct file, there are several members, including this pointer to something called a struct file operations. And this tells the kernel, how do I do things with this file? How do I read from it? How do I write to it? Because there's different kinds of files, depending on what file system they're using. Or is it a file that's mounted remotely, like in the lab? You're accessing files in your home directory, but they aren't in the machine you're in front of. Or is it one on a local disk? Those are going to have different implementations. And the way the Linux kernel implements this, this sort of modularity, is they have a pointer to a table of how to do those operations. And that table is just a structure full of function pointers. So this means that if you happen to find, so full of function pointers, so like here's the read function for this kind or for one kind of file. So if you want to do a read, you look up the fop for the file you want to use, you pass the file to the read function you find, and the stuff and where you want the read data to go. And this means that if you find an exploit in the Linux kernel, well, there's lots of pointers around for you to overwrite, or pointers to pointers to that will be eventually be called. In fact, because this is something like read, if you overwrite a particular one of these pointers to a list of file operations, and then you want to call that pointer, well, you just read a particular file. You've done it. And this is often how an actual method that people use for like exploiting the Linux kernel once they find a memory bug. So that they'll set up one of these functions, they'll overwrite an appropriate function pointer and do something that will use it on something like a file. And this occurs in pretty much everything you can think of accessing in, say, a Linux system. And this strategy is not unique to Linux. This is very common among low-level code where you need different versions of things for different implementations, like files or network connections, etc. So another big use is in implementing C++ what are called virtual functions. So I assumed when I was originally preparing this, until I thought about it earlier this week, that you would know what virtual functions are, but you probably don't have that sort of introduction to C++. But virtual functions mean functions which behave like you expect inherited functions with polymorphic functions to behave in Java. That is, you have a superclass which declares a function, and you have a pointer to something of that, or a reference to something of that superclass, which might be a subclass. You call a function, and it calls the subclass's version. So that feature in C++ is almost always implemented with function pointers internally. You never write code with function pointers, but that's what the actual implementation is. And in fact, it looks very, very much like what the Linux kernel was doing there, which was having a pointer to a list of operations and using that table of pointers to actually do that. So if you have, say, some C++ stuff, so I assume you haven't seen this syntax before, but this is how you declare an abstract method in C++. And this colon public syntax is how you declare extends. Why it looks like that, some bad decisions were made. And the virtual keyword says that I want this function lookup to actually be based on the real type of the object, not whatever kind of pointer I have to it. If you don't use virtual, very not intuitively, C++ will decide I'm going to just call the version of the method for whatever type of pointer or reference you have, even if that's not what the object really points to. C++ does this because they never want to sacrifice performance for sanity. So we have this sort of simple hierarchy. We have an input stream class, a seekable integer stream class. These are abstract classes. And we have a concrete implementation here. And the implementation of these in C++ is that at the beginning of each of these objects, in a typical C++ implementation, is going to be what's called a vtable pointer. And that vtable pointer will point to a bunch of slots for each function that we have that the class had to implement. So in the case of our seekable input stream, the vtable pointer will point to a table with a pointer to the get function for that actual object, a pointer to the seek function, and a pointer to the tell function. And we have a concrete implementation, then it's going to have the vtable pointer followed by whatever data members it has. For example, in this case, the actual file that we're writing. And its vtable pointer will point to real implementations of those methods, real functions that implement them. And you'll notice here that if I look at this file input stream object here, like it's an input stream, the vtable pointers coincide exactly. And that's deliberate. So this way, if I want to convert a pointer to a file input stream to a pointer to an input stream, I just do nothing. Because if I interpret this file input stream as an input stream, everything works out correctly. And similarly, the vtables are laid out that way. The vtable for the input stream and the seekable input stream have the get entry in the same place, and that's deliberate. That's so I can use this vtable, the same vtable here, for both input stream and seekable input stream, and call the functions and everything will work correctly. So I'm not telling you how multiple inheritance works or interfaces, and that's deliberate. It's more complicated. But this is sort of single inheritance. This is how it works in C++. And this gives us some great candidates for things that exploit writers might want to overwrite. Namely, that if you set this vtable pointer to somewhere, it points to functions that you will actually run when you do something like get a character from an input stream. So if you can find an object somewhere and overwrite its vtable, that's a good candidate. And this is something you can probably do with a normal buffer overflow. Is there an object next to you, next to your buffer on the stack? Well, now you have a target without going all the way to the return address. So, as I said, the way these vtables work is that this is basically what the code looks like when you have something that uses a vtable. There's a vtable entry in this input stream, which has the same layout as the real concrete types at the beginning, and you just call the get function with a copy of it. And that's what your simple call to sget will turn into. So any questions on how vtables work? And why attackers might want to change them? Yeah.
Is
So the question is, how do they get to the vtable to change it? So there's basically two options. So the vtables appear in every instance of these types, is the important thing. So if you can somehow either figure out the address of a file input stream, or say one is next to your buffer, then you can use a buffer overflow to overwrite part of it, namely the vtable pointer part. And rather than just letting you break reading from files, you can actually use this to run the code you want, because the vtable pointer is a pointer to addresses of code we will actually run. There's varying ways the attacker would get at it. It can both be just the normal buffer overflow, just like we got to the return address, or it can be something like that finding a pointer on the stack technique, and using that to where we like say we know there's a global variable that's a file input stream. Well, then you know the address of this vtable pointer. You know where that global variable is, and in many applications that could be a fixed address that you could just look up in object dump, just like we looked up where the printf entry in the global offset table was. So we've seen like two ways we've attacked these tables of function pointers that we saw. So one thing is that the easiest thing is we can just, if we know the address of a table entry, which happened for the global offset table with linking, because that was fixed in the binary, we could look it up with object dump, we just overwrite it directly. For vtables, this actually doesn't work, because vtables usually are in read-only memory, just like code. But with vtables, you just need to create a copy of the table somewhere. Basically, you need to create a list of pointers to code you want to be run, which if you know where the code you want to be run is, you can just put that in your buffer, or you can make sure it ends up in a global variable somewhere, like a pointer to a string, and you set the vtable pointer to point to that. And one reason it might seem kind of silly that we're talking about like vtables and these sorts of alternatives when we had what seemed like a really easy technique with the global offset table, that seems maybe more straightforward. We're going to have cases where looking at vtables is easier than the other strategy. We'll come up later when we talk about different kinds of memory errors, which is going to be easier to exploit in different ways. And there's going to be mitigations which will solve some of these problems and not others. Yeah. So in option two, what we might do, if we go back to this example, is that instead of having this pointer point to the global offset table, it would point to a vtable entry. And this buffer, instead of containing machine code, would contain a list of, would start with like 10 copies of the address of the buffer, the address of like the end of the buffer, where our machine code was. And that would be a way you could do this. Another way you could do this is if, let's say, you knew a global variable contained the address of this buffer, you could set, instead of having this val point to the buffer, you point to that global variable. That's a pretty realistic scenario in many applications where they might put the thing they're processing in a global variable somewhere. So now that we've talked about sort of ways of exploiting code beyond using stack smashing, I'm going to take a look at a case study, which I've simplified a bit. So this is exploiting a bug. This is from someone who chronicled how they exploited a bug in a program called NTPD, which is the Network Time Protocol Daemon. And this is a nice attractive target because it's commonly run on many systems, including where this person did their proof of concept, which was OS X at the time, and commonly runs with very high privileges because often changing the system time is a very highly privileged operation, just because you can mess up programs doing that. So traditionally, it's been restricted. And it's a network thing, so you can attack it from the network. And they had a bug, which was that they had this code here, which could overflow a buffer. But this wasn't something you could actually exploit using stack smashing. So even though you could overflow this buffer this way, that the length checking, there was some length checking, but it was wrong, basically. The problem was that this buffer, this pointer here, this data PT, pointed to a global variable. So this buffer was in the global variable space. So it's not next to a return address. We needed to find something else to exploit. And the most obvious thing that they found was that there was this, the buffer was this global array, and we had this pointer which pointed to the current location in the buffer. And the pointer happened to be at a higher address than the buffer. So if you overflowed the buffer enough, you would get to the pointer that was being used to write the buffer. And this is very handy. And this is a sort of common situation if you found an overflow in a global variable, right? There's going to be some global pointer nearby. Maybe not to the same buffer like was lucky enough to happen in this case, but to something that often you as an attacker can control by giving the program input. And so the basic form of this attack is to take advantage of handy function pointers by overwriting this pointer and using things that are written based on this pointer to overwrite the thing that then points to. So the basic procedure is going to be that we're going to overwrite this overflow this buffer and change the data pointer to point to a location of our choice. And then we're going to trigger the error bug again and cause this memmove to happen again with the new value of the pointer that we just changed. And this time, we have to choose what goes in the place we decided to point to. So we're going to change some other function pointer in the program to point to the code we actually want to run. And the person who did this exploit had a really clever technique. So the simplest thing you might imagine doing is changing this to point to the buffer and putting some machine code in there. But this wasn't actually possible on the system they were targeting. In the system they were targeting, they had a mitigation in place, which we will talk about later, of making this buffer not be executable as code, which we will talk about how that works later, and how much that helps or doesn't help. But they had a workaround, which we'll talk about later. But they needed a target address to exploit. And the target they were going to use is that they found out that right after this memmove, there was a call to stringlen. And stringlen's a library function. That means it was implemented on the system by looking up in the global offset table the real address of stringlen and jumping there. So their target address is going to be the global offset table for stringlen. That entry which says, where is the library's implementation of stringlen that you loaded? And we're gonna see that it's gonna be important here that they get to choose what string gets passed to stringlen, which is really handy. So they're gonna do that sort of arc injection, that return to useful code that's already there thing that we saw earlier. So we have our global variable, our buffer, and our pointer to the buffer that we're going to overflow. And the clever part of the exploit here is that what we're going to make stringlen end up pointing to. So what we're going to do is we're going to overflow the buffer and make data pointer point to the stringlen entry. Then we're going to overwrite the value of that entry with, for example, the address of the system function, where system is a library function that when you call it, runs a command line command. And wouldn't that be a handy thing to run with the string we supply? So the first step of our procedure is we overflow this buffer all the way up to this global variable that's supposed to point to it and make it point to the stringlen entry. And we do this by sending one command to the vulnerable program, which doesn't check the length of the thing it's writing to the buffer. Then we tell the program to write another thing to its data pointer, which no longer points in the correct place, and overwrite the string len entry to point to the system stub, the procedure linkage table entry, the thing which looks up the system's global offset table entry and jumps to it, which is a fixed address we could find by object dumping the executable. And then, once we've done that, the program's going to call stringlen using this global offset table entry with an argument of our choice, which is going to call system, which is not going to get the length of the string we passed it. It's going to run it as a command. And that lets us do whatever we want. So this, I will note, is one example of why I said that that it was very common for programs to have useful code for us to already run in them. Like, this function is a very common library function. It makes sense that it would exist in the program, in the libraries at least. And it was enough to get us in trouble, even without like particular code that calls it. So any questions on this procedure? So a nice thing about this exploit is that we didn't need to figure out that all the addresses we needed. We didn't need to guess any addresses. We didn't need to run any debuggers. All the addresses we needed are things which would be listed by object dump. Like, you could write this exploit, just object dump the executable, read the code to figure out where the buffer data pointer is initialized to figure out where the buffer is, and figure out how far apart they are. Yeah.
How did you change the
string len GOT? So the question is, how do we change the string len GOT entry? So this is, I guess, the most confusing part of this. So there's two. We're gonna run this mem move here twice. So the first time we run it, we're going to change data PT. That is all we're going to change the first time. And then we're going to be hopefully lucky enough that changing these other global variables here doesn't affect anything. And then we're going to cause this to run a second time. We're going to send a second message to the program that could potentially overflow a buffer. And the second time, it's going to read data PT, and rather than pointing to somewhere in the middle of this buffer, it points to the string len global offset table entry. And we're going to supply a string that will overwrite that global offset table entry. So we need to call this exploitable code twice, but this is a network program. It like reads a message from the network and does something. We can send multiple messages. So we first do the setup where we make the pointer go to the wrong place, and second do this overwrite. So it's not like the original scenario I showed you for an arbitrary memory write where it was all in one. We overflowed the buffer once and we changed a pointer and the value being written to that pointer. Here we overflow the buffer once to change the pointer and then do something else to write to that pointer. And this is actually pretty common. There's many real exploits which are based on this sort of two-step strategy. First, you corrupt a pointer that you aren't supposed to be able to change. And second, you call something or send a command which will use something that uses that corrupted pointer. Okay. So other questions, confusion? So this is the basic form of the exploit. I've simplified things a bit. So the real exploit, there's a blog post which I got this from, which is formative. It's more complicated because there were more mitigations than just like the stack, than the like global variable space not being executable. They couldn't actually write zeros, which was a bit of a challenge for writing addresses, but they could work around that. And actually getting to this buffer overflow turned out to be pretty complicated. You have to send a very specially crafted command because there were supposed to be checks that you were an authorized user before you could access the functionality where this buffer overflow was. But those are details as far as we're concerned. Just to show you that this is a little more complicated than that, but this is a very recent exploit, like 2014. And this is sorts of things which seem like it's hard to mitigate against. Something like stack canaries, it's hard to see how that sort of solution would help against this. Even something, if you could imagine some variation of stack canaries with global variables, it's hard to imagine where you check or anything like that. Okay, so any questions about this example? So, as I alluded to earlier, we're going to talk about lots of ways of exploiting memory errors. And the big lesson that I want you to get out of this, which a lot of people didn't get when stack smashing was a thing, is that pretty much every single memory error is going to be a problem. It's going to be something that an attacker can take advantage of. And this is something we as defenders need to know, because there's a lot of defenses which are proposed, which are effective against a class of exploits, but aren't going to really solve the problem, because there's such a variety of techniques attackers have found, which tend to show up whenever you allow any sort of memory error. And so I'm going to go through these bunch of common problems that have been exploitable in the past. Some of these are more exploitable than others. So we're going to talk about off-by-one buffer overflows. There have been real cases in real programs that were common where off-by-one errors were exploitable by an attacker to execute arbitrary code. And there's a reason for this, which is not just the attacker getting really, really lucky, which I'll talk about in a bit. So I'll also talk about the analogy for stack smashing for overflowing heap buffers. So it's not going to be as generic as stack smashing, but it turns out that there's a pretty generic technique for something that's allocated with newer malloc, and you can overflow a buffer in it. There's going to be something like a return address you can overwrite. It's not going to be a return address. There's going to be something like that you can overwrite and do whatever you like. And this is going to be called heap smashing. So there's also other memory bugs which you don't think of as sort of buffer overflows, which cause the same sorts of problems. So for example, historically, but not anymore, double frees were often exploitable. You could often execute arbitrary code if a program freed something and then erroneously freed it again. This is not exploitable anymore, because now modern allocators, because of this problem, check for this, even though it might cost a little bit of performance. And a common problem that affects programs even very, very recently is use after free bugs. So if you free some memory and keep using it somewhere, this is very often actually exploitable by an attacker to run arbitrary code. And another common case is integer overflows. So if you do some size calculation and you have an integer overflow, which is very subtle, this is commonly made real programs have something which doesn't look like a buffer overflow. You're checking sizes, but in fact is. I mentioned these last two categories are particularly interesting, because they're things where simply doing bounds checking, like you would normally do, doesn't solve the problem. And that's something which is a lot of modern exploits are from those sorts of bugs, because people have usually figured out how to avoid the sort of classical buffer overflow problems. So to start out, let's talk about how an off-by-one error can turn into running arbitrary code, and how it can do this reasonably consistently across many programs. So the assumption we're going to make is that the thing we're getting the off-by-one error is a buffer allocated in a function, and we don't have anything like stack canaries. And we use a feature which you haven't seen in x86 64, but you may have seen on 32-bit x86, called frame pointers. So who here has ever heard of frame pointers? So on 32-bit x86, these are very common. In the 64-bit code we've shown you, They don't appear, and they aren't strictly necessary. So there's something that has commonly been used in addition to stack pointers. And the basic idea is that, well, it's annoying to remember how much stuff I allocated on the stack in a function. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to keep a frame pointer, and the frame pointer register on x86-64 is RBP, called the base pointer. That's what the name comes from. And that's going to point to the beginning of my stuff for my function, when I'm in the function. And then I have this stack pointer, which points to the end. Now, this is redundant. If I know how much stuff my function allocates, I don't need this information. And this is why you don't see this in modern compiler-generated code. The compiler can keep track of this, and it does. Yeah. So often this is done in 32-bit, and you can see this done in 64-bit. It is not necessary. The calling convention does not say you have to do this. How would they know? There's no way of, all you need to know is whether you need to save this register or not, and you need to save it. Otherwise, you follow the calling convention regardless of whether you do this. But most commonly, compilers have done this. And this means that functions would have predictable prologues and epilogues. In fact, this was so common that x86 has a special instruction, pair of instructions, for setting up frame pointers, which also exists in 32-bit mode, called enter and leave. So this enter function is the same as move the stack pointer to the frame pointer and subtract something from the stack pointer. So save the stack pointer in the frame pointer, and then subtract, and the leave function moves the frame pointer to the stack pointer and pops, and then pops the stack, I'm not, I think it, yeah, and it pops into the frame pointer. Okay, so these exist as conventions, and commonly it's used. And there's some advantages to using this. So one thing is, if you're writing code by hand, it's certainly a lot easier to keep track of the base frame pointer rather than remembering, oh, I put 120 up here, I better put 120 down here. It's much less error prone if you're writing by hand. The other big advantage is that this is much easier for debuggers to use. So a debugger which can handle this code is going to need to figure out this 120 in order to figure out what function called this. On modern systems, we have ways of doing that. There's basically debugging information with tables of how much stuff is on the stack above the return address everywhere. But that isn't something we've always done. And if you have a frame pointer, well, you can easily find the return address as a debugger, and you can easily make a stack trace without tables like that, without having compilers that know how to make those tables. So when we have code with frame pointers, this is going to be an opportunity for us. And to show you this, let's look at the layout when we have stack pointers and frame pointers with two functions. So we have a frame pointer and a stack pointer, something like this. We can decide about which side RBP is on. And we have a saved frame pointer. That's the important thing here. So we've saved the frame pointer somewhere in order to restore it at the end of the function. And we're doing this because this is like one of the big advantages of using frame pointers is that we don't need to remember how much we decremented the stack pointer by. And we avoid that because by just having a copy of the old frame pointer. So we set our stack pointer to here, restore the frame pointer, and we don't need to remember at any point how much to decrement things by. And our calling function doesn't need to remember because we saved its frame pointer for it. Yes?
So after the pointers are saved for foo, are they only storing the values for bar?
So after we save the frame pointer for foo, in bar we only have pointers to the stack space for bar. But fortunately, our pointer to our frame pointer tells us where to find the save pointer to the stuff that foo needs.
Okay.
And it's this frame pointer here that's going to be important. So here's an example of a potentially vulnerable function. So this function has an off by one bug, which you can see because that should be strictly less than. And these bugs are much more common than just general buffer overflows because usually people remember, oh, I need to check the size of the thing I'm writing. And it's really easy to make these mistakes. And so we're going to be able to write one byte past the end of the buffer. And the hope is that that one byte is going to be in the saved frame pointer. So the stack setup is going to be that we're invulnerable, we're writing the buffer, and it goes up right against that safe frame pointer, which isn't uncommon. Our compiler, when it's compiling that function, doesn't want to waste space in the stack. It's going to use all of it. So we write one byte past the end. So we overwrite a little bit of the safe frame pointer. So this is going to change the address that is in the frame pointer. So when we return from vulnerable, we're going to restore the frame pointer not to here, but to somewhere else. And somewhere else that varies by some amount. And ideally, a great place to restore it to would be, say, in the middle of this buffer. So if we do that, then we have to think of what's going to happen at the end of other. And if you look at the code we have here, at the end of other, we use that frame pointer we got and set it to be the stack pointer. Then we pop something from the stack and then return. And returning means that we're using the stack pointer, namely we got from the frame pointer, to jump to some code. So if that stack pointer ends up pointing in the middle of our buffer, we've won. We now control the address this return goes to instead of it being the original location. So what ends up happening is that we point to the middle of the buffer, and now this is what the other function is going to use after it copies the frame pointer to its stack pointer when it's done. Instead of going back up here, it's going to go down here. And it's going to read its caller's frame pointer back off the stack, and then it's going to jump to this address. Yeah. For this mistake to happen. So off by one errors are, like, this sort of error is real. They are things that programmers often make in practice. So who here has made an off by one error like this sort of thing? Yeah, pretty much everyone. And they happen, but professional programmers do it too, all the time. Because it's hard to keep track of, you know, whether you're supposed to use less than or less than equals, or whether you're supposed to add one because it's one based or not, whether you're supposed to make room for a null byte or not. So you make these mistakes. So the errors happen for that reason. And this is where people have seen this in the wild on compilers which use frame pointers because of, like, just innocent programmer mistakes. Okay. So I noticed one limitation here. This is an off by one error, and this is off by one byte. So we don't just get to set the frame pointer anywhere. We only get to set the last byte of it. So on systems where the byte with the lowest address is at least significant, this happens to be changing it by at most 256. So that's a limitation. But if you look at this, well, that's probably not a change by more than 256. Um, Also, often a common form of these bugs is that someone forgets that they need a null terminator to a string in C. So sometimes the off by one error only lets you write a zero. But if we look back at this example, we're changing it from pointing up here, a higher address, to a lower one. So this means that often, even if the only thing you can have be put there is a zero, you can still exploit it. And that sort of off by one error is very common, because forgetting about null characters happens all the time. So this is a real thing. And after you control the frame pointer, you just make sure that above where you set the frame pointer to is going to be a return address. And just like with stack smashing, we can't use a NOP slide here, right? This is not like this is not the address of code that's being executed, but we could just put a whole lot of copies of the address. Or something like that if we wanted to not have to guess exactly what the address is. So the end result is the same as stack smashing, but we only needed an off by one error. We didn't need an arbitrary buffer overflow. We just needed to deal with this little innocent mistake the programmer made. We can only be off by one. How bad could it be? It's only one byte. Turns out to be bad. We can also do things besides changing the return address, like we can potentially control variables of the function if the compiler accesses them based on the frame pointer. And that might be useful even if we can't set the return address to something useful. So as I said, this is something which has really happened. So I'd like to show you some example code which had this vulnerability. And this is from an implementation of a function called RealPath. And I believe this code originated in BSD, the Berkeley Standard Distribution of Unix, way back. And appeared in lots of places. And this came up in particular at one point because it, in the late 90s, I think, was remotely exploitable in a commonly used file transfer protocol daemon. So I'm guessing almost no one has used FTP. So FTP used to be a common way to download files. Now we all use HTTP, but used to be. So this was basically a server for files, like files you might distribute, like programs and things like that. And it had a bad length check. So can you see the bug here? Any questions on this code besides bugs? Yeah.
Why does it say plus one?
So the question is, why does it say plus one? That's because they wanted space for a null character. So what's the bug? Can you guess what the programmer did? And if you don't know, string cat is a function which adds to the end of a string, of a null terminated string. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be that like it wasn't too long before, but then when you add to it, it becomes too long?
Yeah. So the bug actually was that they were controlling. It's resolved, which is also the same, declared the same. I'm missing information here. But resolved is what's overflowed, because that's what's written here. And what they did is they said, is resolved too long? That's what they're saying, is resolved too long? So we look at resolved plus wbuf, what's in resolved now plus what's in wbuf. So resolved is declared the same way. It's resolved, max path len, it's on the stack. Plus root d, which is supposed to indicate, well, do we need an extra slash or not? And plus one for the null character. And the people programming this forgot that they used zero as the value of root d if they needed an extra slash, and one otherwise, and not the other way around. So they were trying to account for this extra slash, but they needed to like do one minus this or something like that to do that. And that was the mistake they made. And it turned out that this resolve buffer was right up against a frame pointer, and this allowed you to put a null character in the last byte of the frame pointer, and it was exploitable. So, does that make sense? Questions? And you can see this is a sort of a very subtle bug which almost never comes up in testing. Yeah? So the question is, I mentioned that even if you don't change the return address, variables could be changed. So often a thing which will happen in this code here when you're using frame pointers is that local variables will be accessed by saying like for RBP or something like that. So it'll be accessed based on the frame pointer. And so for example, in like the quiz example, the score might be one of those. So even though you didn't overwrite the score, you can make the program think the score is stored in a different memory location, and it's going to happily read that memory location and report it as a score. And other things which are dependent on the program you're using, but if you have some exploitable function, you know, that's like checking if you're authorized or not, could sure be useful to have it have different local variables. Yeah?
Said it never comes up in testing, but would it be that hard to write something that tests the buffer overflows?
So, is it hard? So, the question is it hard to test? So, it's not hard to come up with a test which does this. But you do need to be looking for it.
But couldn't you write like a general purpose check for buffer
overflows? So couldn't you write a general purpose check for buffer overflows? We will probably get to that topic later. It is a complicated topic. And this, I think, example sort of illustrates why. So in this case, the buffer overflow is conditional on, it's by one. So it's conditional on the length of resolve plus wbuff being exactly equal to this minus one, which means that you need to set up the situation, you need to construct the situation so it happens. So there are strategies for looking at code and trying to say, can this code have a buffer overflow? And maybe we'll talk about that later. I'm kind of undecided on how much of that sort of topic to talk about. But doing that sort of from a code-only perspective is very complicated. You're trying to like look at code and figure out what's possible, and you need to come up with a particular situation that triggers that. Now, certainly, as someone like a human testing this code, something you should do when you see a check like this is say, what happens when I make this exactly equal. Is that case actually handled correctly when it's exactly equal or minus one plus one? Certainly you should look at that, but that's not an easy thing to have automated tools do. Like, you can't, you need to do some very sophisticated analysis to like have something which looks at this statement and then backtracks through the code to figure out how do I make resolved be exactly max len minus however long wbuff is. That's pretty complicated to do automatically. So there's other sorts of automated tools we can have. Like we can do bounds checking, right? We could do something more easily, which when we do have this bug happen, where instead of letting this string cat and this string cat go to over the end of the buffer and write a null character, we fail. That is something we could do. Those things are easier to understand how you do that. But they're going to have some performance costs because we're doing it at runtime. We're not just looking at the code for the problem. But it's certainly something worth thinking about. And when you're thinking about mitigations, you need to. Big reason we're going over this is that knowing what the variety is helps you understand what mitigations might be effective. So this is a case where clearly stack canaries maybe don't. They do something, but don't really solve the problem. Where and some other things don't really some types of mitigations you might think of don't solve the problem. And some do. Okay. So other questions? Okay, so I will, in the 10 minutes, start heap buffer overflows. I'll see if we actually finish them, but probably we'll leave off after giving you the introduction to why is overflowing things that are malloc actually exploitable. So far, we've looked at overflows of like global variables, and typically global variables are all allocated together, they're all at fixed locations. That's really convenient for an attacker. It's consistent. They can know when they go over the, have a memory error that goes outside of the buffer that's supposed to be accessed, they can know what's there. And for the stack, we know where return addresses are relative to our buffers, and that gave us something predictable. So a question we might have, is there something like that for things that are mapped? And I'll start with the easy case. So just like on the stack, there are some application-specific cases where, well, there happens to be something interesting next to our buffer, like the score for the quiz. So like if I have this struct here with a buffer and a function pointer, then and I overflow this buffer, well, it's pretty easy to see what sort of good target I have for what I'm going to overflow. But that's kind of getting lucky. Because I had to be lucky enough that there was some structure which contained both the data I was using and some function pointers afterwards, which wasn't what happened with vtables, that I could overwrite. Some people seem confused on the order of this. Addresses are going up. So this is the lowest address, this is the highest address. And it is in fact a rule in C that when you declare a struct, the first thing in the struct is at the lowest address. So, but yeah, we don't want to depend on this sort of thing. We don't want to depend on there being anything useful in the thing that was malloc. Like someone just malloc'd a buffer for us or something. We don't expect there to be something in the same object that was malloc'd that we can necessarily overwrite that will be useful. So let's look at another case. And this is where vtables are often more convenient, one case. So let's say we have an object with a buffer and some virtual functions in C++. In this case, these objects are going to have a vtable, so we know which implementation of the virtual function to use when we call something. And they're going to be on the heap somewhere. So we're going to call malloc, or new in this case. We're going to call new. We're going to get objects. And they're going to be allocated somewhere on the heap. And we might not know exactly what the allocator is doing, but it's going to be pretty common for memory allocators to return memory locations that are close to each other. It's hard to imagine a way you'd implement an allocator where you wouldn't do that, right? You get a bunch of memory. You get the next bunch of memory. It's probably going to be pretty common that they'll happen to be next to each other. So our buffer overflow strategy here is just we just need to guess how far apart they are, and we can overwrite a vtable pointer, and we can make it point to the global offset table at the appropriate place, so like we can call system when they try to call some method of v, or something like that. So this seems actually, in things like a C++ program, pretty reliable. Like if a C++ program is all the time allocating objects that have polymorphic functions, then we can probably do this reliably. All we need to do is guess how big allocations are, and probably the allocator is pretty consistent. Like it's going to have the same amount of extra space in between. But we can do better.
Will malloc generally allocate addresses in the same place on separate runs of the same program?
So the question is, will malloc generally allocate addresses in the same place in separate runs of the program? So this is a bit of a complicated question, but for the same reason that the stack addresses varied when we were running the program in slightly different ways. So ignoring deliberate attempts to choose random addresses, the answer is yes. And generally, so modern systems do have those, and we'll talk about them because they exist specifically because of this problem. But otherwise, yeah, it's consistent. Like, why would you write your allocator to do random stuff? Like, there's not a performance reason to do this. It doesn't make it easier to debug your allocator. So the easiest thing to implement, the easiest thing to test is going to be an allocator which just does the same thing each time as long as you have the same sequence of allocations. So it is consistent. And when people actually exploit these bugs, a common thing that they'll do is they'll replace the memory allocator with a wrapper which prints the address that malloc and freeware got and calls the real memory allocator. Just because it's consistent enough that they can test the program that way, figure out what all the addresses they care about are, and use that to have something like, put something like, have the vtable point to a buffer they supplied, and that would consistently work. So we have this example here, which was just depending on there being function pointers in things allocated on the heap. And because of things like vtables, that actually is very common and something that we could often actually take advantage of. But we have an even better strategy. And the basis of this strategy is going to be how malloc and new are implemented. So typically, malloc and new put things around the objects they allocate to keep track of them. And our strategy is going to be to overwrite that information with our buffer overflow and cause malloc and new to have corrupted pointers and things like that, and use those corrupted pointers to do things that the attacker chooses, like overwrite the global offset table entry for string length. So I will just finish up by giving a preview. So a common implementation technique, which is one we'll talk about, is managing, and not the only one, but we'll talk about just this one and talk about how to exploit it. So there are other implementation techniques which are going to have different details, different levels of exploitability, but this is a common one, and this sort of strategy is actually very common in malloc implementations. And the basic idea is that we're going to keep track of some information for every sort of chunk of memory that we're managing. And for everything, including allocated objects, we're going to keep track of whether it's free or not and how big it is. So for an allocated object, we'll have just that information and then the object right away. For an unallocated object, we're going to also keep track of pointers to the previous and next chunk of memory. So we're going to have a linked list of free chunks of memory, and we're going to use that linked list when someone calls malloc or new. We're going to go through our list of chunks of memory, look at each of them, look at the size, see if it's big enough, and return one that is big enough. And so what we'll talk about next time is, well, if you can overwrite these things, how can you turn that into something useful for an attacker? And because these pointers existing only depends on using a particular implementation of malloc, which probably almost every program on a particular operating system does, this is a pretty generic technique. The only really tricky part is you need to figure out how far from the end of the allocated object the previous and next pointers are, which is going to be consistent based on how much is allocated by the program. Okay, so that's what I have for today. Here to take questions. Thank you.